Okay, everybody, good afternoon. Today is January 7th, 2015, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues in Houston, Texas, for our class in Parshat HaShavua, and today we are going to be studying Parshat Shemot, the first Parsha in the book of Shemot. And we are going to be looking at the first two chapters in Parshat Shemot. Okay, so there are Tanakhs floating around, and also one individual sheet of paper printed on both sides. So everyone just has one sheet of paper. Okay, so here we go.
What page are we on?
We are on page 113. So the book of Shemot, the entire book of the second of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the five books of Moses, actually begins by laying out two opposite developments regarding B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel. The first is, and the first one caused the second one. The first development is the growth of the Jewish people, right? The incredibly fast growth of the Jewish people. For example, we could see the growth of the Jewish people even back in the book of Genesis. If you turn to chapter 47, verse 27, on page 104, we see as follows. Vayeshev Yisrael be'eretz Mitzrayim be'eretz Goshen ve'achzu va vayifru vayirbu ma'od. Israel settled in Egypt, and they acquired holdings, and were fertile, and increased greatly. Right, so the Jewish people are growing in great numbers, and this is confirmed at the beginning of Shemot, where if you look in Shemot 1:7 on page 113, we have a similar pasuk. We're going to come back to this pasuk, but just for the purposes of showing this development, Uvnei Yisrael paru v'yishritu v'yirbu v'yatzmu b'maod me'od v'timalei ha'aretz otam.
Is that a miracle, Rabbi?
It does not seem.
Work.
It doesn't seem
you
to.
You started off with seven.
We don't know what the numbers are at this
started
point.
Started off with seven.
Right, but at this point we don't know what the numbers are.
Why did this repeat? This is the same thing it's at the end of the last.
Well, we'll see. It may not be the same thing. We're gonna get there. But you see, in both of these psukim, we have an indication that the Jewish people are growing in leaps and bounds. Right, they went down.
The second pasuk.
The pasuk Aleph Zion 1:7 in Shemot, page 113. Okay, so the Jewish people go down, right? B'nai Yisrael go to Mitzrayim with 70 people, and within a small amount of time, relatively speaking, they grow into a nation. And Scott asks a good question. Was that miraculous? There's nothing in the text to indicate that the text doesn't consider it a miracle. Maybe we'll see later what the midwives, what they thought was the reason, perhaps, for the faith of the Jewish people. That's one development, the quick growth of the Jewish people. The other, and apparently they're settled well in Mitzrayim, and the second development is, in a small amount of time, the attempt to diminish the number of Jews on the part of Paro. Right? So we have these two parallel but opposite developments that are all happening at the beginning of Shemot. A record that the Jewish people are growing very quickly, and a decision by Paro to try to diminish the number of Jews in Mitzrayim. I want to show you quickly some parallels between the end of the book of Bereshit and the beginning of the book of Shemot, the end of Genesis, the beginning of Exodus. And this will address your question, Eddie, that it seems like we have a repetition. So what we really have is we have at the beginning of Shemot a quick recap of what was told to us at the end of Bereshit at length, with one very important difference, which is going to explain to us perhaps what Paro was thinking. So, for example, let's focus our attention. To the end of Sefer Bereshit. Again, we're going to look at chapter 46 for a moment. Actually, what I'm going to ask you to do is something a little bitting. I want your finger on page 99, and I also want you to keep the place at the beginning of Exodus on page 113. We're going to be doing a lot of flipping back and forth. So, for example, in chapter 46, verse 8, which is on page 100, the Bible says, Ve'eleh shemot b'nei Yisrael ha've'im Mitzrayima, Yaakov uvanav, b'chor Yaakov u'uvein. These are the names of the Israelites, Jacob and his descendants who came to Egypt. And then the Torah goes on to give us all of their names. Right? Everyone see that? Mm-hmm. A list of all the names. Flip to Exodus. 1:1. Also, Ve'eleh shemot b'nei Yisrael ha'ba'im Mitzrayima, Eit Yaakov, Ishu Veto Ba'u. And then we have the names just of the brothers without the names of the brothers' sons. So it's sort of an abridged version of what we already saw in Exodus. Everyone following? Okay. We have another example of this. Right, I'm sorry. So the next example of this, as I mentioned, is the complete mention of all the names of Yaakov's sons and their sons, Yaakov's grandchildren, at the end of Exodus, while at the beginning of Exodus, we just have a digested version just of the names of the brothers themselves. And then we have a record of the death of Joseph. In chapter 50 of Bereshit, which is page 111, the very last verse of the book of Bereshit, Vayamat Yosef, ben mea ve'eser shanim, vayachantu oto, vayisem be'aron b'mitrayim. Joseph died at the age of 110, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. We have that again back in Exodus. Now you can take your hand out of the Genesis portion, because we're now going to stay the Genesis portion, the Exodus portion, which is chapter 1, verse 6. Vayamat Yosef, Joseph dies. But now, Shemot adds something. What does Shemot add? V'chol Echav, v'chol Hador Ahu. What is it? What's the Torah doing? Why is it doing this? Yes, but it's doing something else. It's pushing the story. We got to close the gap of time, right? In the end of Genesis, Joseph died, but everyone else is still alive. But now enough time has passed that Joseph died, all of his brothers died, and that entire generation, everyone who came down to Egypt, presumably from Eretz Canaan, are all gone, right? And what else happens? The very next, in one verse after that, verse 8, Vayaka Melech Hadash. What else is new? There's a new Egyptian reality, right? There's a new reality in Bnei Yisrael. They're all gone. All that generation that had that positive, good relationship with Egypt, all gone. And there's a new leadership in Egypt as well. Asher lo yadat Yosef. It makes sense. It's a lot of years have passed. That's why we have to know, that's why the Torah tells us that Joseph and the whole generation died. What do you mean the king didn't know Joseph? Joseph was very popular. Well, he was, but that was 60, 70 years ago. Time has passed. There's a new king, and he didn't know Joseph. And the Torah, by giving us these tzupsukim, is showing us that there's a whole new reality. Time has passed. 70 or so years have passed. And that's where the new story is going
to
begin.
Why did they return back to Israel after
the famine was over?
They should go back. Jews don't do that.
Good question.
Was Joseph the first one to die? Or just
of the brothers, it sounds like. The first recorded one to die.
No, they just went for food.
Now, yes.
What about the the children of the sons of Joseph?
All gone.
Wait a
it
second,
sounds
but
like.
They were supposed to be equal to the other brothers' children.
In inheriting.
Right, they become tribes, but they're dead.
Yeah, they're dead.
They're dead.
But is their name listed here?
Well, no, they don't know, because only list the ones who came down. They were already there with Joseph.
Right, but they're supposed to have also inherited.
Yes,
the mantle, so to speak.
Correct,
yeah.
But they are dead. But they do become tribes. You're 100% correct. Okay, so now let's look at something really interesting. At the end of Genesis, at the end of Bereshit, the Torah tells us, let's go back now. And now if you look at the sheet, we could stop flipping. Look at the sheet that says, what did Paro see? It's this one. Sonny, you want to pass one down? Okay. You could see it better in the Hebrew, but we'll start with the English. Genesis, look at the table. Genesis 47:27. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt and were fruitful and multiplied exceedingly. Eddie asks, isn't this just a repetition? Well, it's not just a repetition. Because look what happens in Exodus. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and waxed exceedingly, and the land was filled with them. It's easier to see in the Hebrew. After every Hebrew word that appears in the description in Genesis, that same word appears in the description in Exodus, but there's an additional word after it which seems to multiply or amplify the experience, right? Look at the Hebrew. Vayifru. In Genesis, it just says they were fruitful. What does it say in Exodus? Paru ve'yishritzu. They were fruitful and increased.
And
it says in Genesis, vayirbu, that they multiplied. And it says in Shemot, vayirbu vayatsmu. They multiplied exceedingly. And it says in Exodus, me'od, a lot. And in Genesis, me'od. And in Exodus, it says, me'od, me'od, more than a lot. And finally, as Sonia points out, the land was filled with them. This is what Paro sees. So this is not just, and again, what's the difference between what's being recorded in Exodus and what's being recorded in Genesis?
There's a gap of time.
Time has gone by, and now they are not only a lot, they are exceedingly a lot. They are not only multiplied, they are multiplying mightily, and the whole land is filled with them, which is a phrase which is completely absent from the description in Sefer Bereshit, in the book of Genesis. So that's what Paro sees here. There are just too many people, too many Jews, and what's he concerned about? Let's look in the text on page 113. Well, we'll see that in a little while. Good point. Excellent. Let's look at page 113. Vayomer Alamo, verse 9. Paro says to his people, Hine am b'nei Yisrael rav ve'atsum mimenu. They are too numerous. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground. He's concerned about a fifth column, right, as we would call it. An internal enemy. Right, because what's going to happen? The Egyptians are going to be attacked from the outside. And instead of being able to dedicate all of their military resources to defending their borders, they're afraid they're going to have to use some of their military resources to keep this foreign population at bay. And so now they're going to be stretched. Their army's going to be stretched too thin. It sounds to me that that's what Paro is concerned about.
But they weren't slaves.
At this point, they weren't slaves. But since they are a foreign entity, Paro's concerned that they don't have loyalty
to... So this is the time they should have left.
Well, yeah, it would have been wild.
Free
yeah.
to go, free to go.
Right, correct. They were free to go.
But
now, what we're going to see is an amazing development, an amazing parallel in the way Paro deals with the problem. Let's look now on this table, okay? So what's the first thing Paro tries to do, right, to limit the number of Jews?
probably make them work harder.
Work hard. Let's look. Stage one. Work decree. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Paro store cities, Pitom and Ramses. This is verse 11. In Exodus 1. Okay? Now, who does Paro tell to enforce this rule? The taskmasters. Taskmasters. Right? Taskmasters. Now, question. Does it work? Does this plan to limit the Jewish population by forcing the Jewish people to work, maybe some of them will die, they'll be too tired. The Midrash says maybe they were too tired to procreate. Does it work?
Not.
How do you know?
We
know it fails for two reasons. First of all, the next pasuk says it failed, right? V'chasher yanu oto kein yirbeh v'chein yifrotz. The more that Paro afflicted them, the more they became. It not only didn't it work, it completely backfired. It worked in the opposite way. So then, now look what Paro does. Verse Yud Gimel. Vayavidu Mitzrayim et Bnei Yisrael b'farach. That the Egyptians worked the Jewish people with rigor. Vayimaru et chayehem b'avodah kasha b'chomer b'ulveinim b'chol v'da b'sadeh et kol avodotam asher avdu behem b'farach. And they made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in field, in all the service wherein they made them serve with rigor. What are some of the important differences between Paro's stage one and Paro's stage two?
Now, the rigor is...
Say that again?
It's more intense.
It's definitely more intense. There's another way you could say that it's more intense.
The first was proactive, the second was reactive.
Well, the first was also reactive to the too many people.
Not just the money, but also physically the...
It sounds harder. The language used there, that it's they embittered their lives. It was hard work. There are two really key distinctions. Who's engaged in carrying out stage two? What does it say in verse Yud Gimel?
The Egyptians.
In verse 11, Paro has a private conversation with his taskmasters and says, look, this is what you have to do. In verse 13, it sounds like people, workers,
there
policemen.
There were Jews.
You know,
they must have been Jews.
No. Paro.
Then what's the difference between them?
The difference is, a big difference. The first is, these are the officials. They're going to work them. The second is, I want every Egyptian citizen to make sure that the Jews are enslaved. Okay? Every Egyptian citizen. Right? To make sure the Jews are enslaved.
And they still multiply.
And what else? There's another difference. The first time Paro enslaved them, what was the purpose?
To keep them at bay.
What does the Torah say? Look inside, verse 11. What was the purpose of the project?
To build garrison cities.
They were going to build two cities. What's the purpose of the project that Paro establishes in verse 13?
It's offensive that he wants.
Read it.
Make bricks.
There seems like there's no purpose. Just make bricks. Just keep going. It's like moving a pile of stones from one pile to another pile. There's no city being built. He's not building garrisons. He's not building things to defend himself. This is work for the sake of work, just to keep the Jews busy.
All the tasks in the field.
Arbeit
macht das Leben süß.
Right? Those are two very important distinctions. In the first stage, which failed, Paro just turns to whoever is in charge of the workforce, the Department of Labor, right? And says, I need the Jews to build me cities. But in the second one, it's a national project of enslavement, of one nation enslaving another nation. And in the first project, there's a point, and in the second project, it seems pointless. Just work. And that's what some of the commentaries say Befarech means. It's just, useless, meaningless physical labor.
Just to wear them out.
But exactly. You just kick them out. They came to Eretz Goshen for a certain purpose. Now,
well, for some reason, Paro didn't think he could kick them out. That's a good point. Now, did it work?
No.
How do we know it didn't work?
Because then they started with the Meyaldot.
Right. On the one hand, we say, no, it didn't work, because then Paro says we have to kill the male. So obviously this is not working. On the other hand, we don't know. It's unclear. But I think Shula makes a good point, that the fact that in the very next verse, in verse 15, Paro then says we have to kill the boys, seems to indicate that the work decree, that middle column in the chart that you have, seems to not have worked, and Paro needs a new plan. What's his new plan? Let's look at verse 15. Vayomer melech Mitzrayim lamiyaldot ha'ivriyot. Now here we got to be very careful. Paro says, now the translation in that you have in the book and on the sheet is Hebrew midwives. There's a debate as to who they were. Were they Jews, or were they Egyptian midwives of the Jews? There's a debate. It's unclear from the text.
What does the name suggest?
Shifra and Pua. That could have been, those could have been Egyptian names that the Jewish people took. Unclear. Moses also had a, Moses, it was an Egyptian name, and he was a Jew.
But so, on the other hand, all the Jews are usually doctors, so for sure they would
be. So it could be, Mialdota Ivriot could be Hebrew midwives, or the midwives who birthed the Hebrews. Unclear. But what is clear is, who is in charge of this stage one?
Stage one.
Stage one. Again, a small group of people. Professionals, whether they're Jewish or not, but they're professionals. And who is supposed to be killed?
All the boys.
Read again.
All the sons.
Read it. Don't guess. Just read it. It's right there. It's in there. Which boys?
It could be a son.
Which boys? Only the ones who they find where? At birth. Only the ones that you find at birth, on the birth stool. Yeah, where they gave birth. That's the text. That's the term. Only at birth. Okay, and we're going to see an important distinction. Did it work?
No.
How do we know? The next pasuk says the midwives didn't do it, and God in fact blesses them. Okay, so didn't work. Now we have stage two. What's stage two? Pasuk 22. What's the difference between stage one and stage two?
Oh, 22. Now whoever is being all his
first of all, now it's a witch hunt. He tells all the Egyptians, right? Verse 22, it's very clear. Vayitza Paro l'chol amo. Before, Paro has a private conversation with the midwives and says, this is what you have to do. It's quiet. It's a quiet, stealth attempt. Now it doesn't work. So now he publishes a public announcement. Vayitzav paro l'chol amo. Every person is now empowered, right? To do what? Kol haben hayilod hayoret l'shichuhu. Every male child, which means what's the difference between the first part and the second part?
Every male child.
Every male child. In the first part, all the male adults were told was when a kid is born, kill him. And now an Egyptian sees a three-year-old playing in the field,
kill him.
Right? Kol haben, every boy. Kol haben hayilod, every boy that is born. The difference is he doesn't limit it to the birth stool.
Now, why are they so discriminating?
And it's not limited to the adult.
Because they are professional. For them, it's more difficult to do that.
Now, so let me ask you, do you see the parallel between what Paro, in both of these stages, Paro does the same thing. In stage one of the work decree, he only says to the taskmasters. And in stage one of the decree to kill the children. He only speaks to the midwives. It doesn't, neither of those work. It's too limited. So in stage two of the work decree, he tells all the Egyptians, enslave the Jews. And in stage two of the decree to kill the kids, the boys, he tells all the Egyptians. Also, in stage one of the work decree, it was limited. We're just going to build Pitom and Ramses. And in stage one of killing the boys, it was limited. Only the ones we find on the birth stool. In stage two, it's endless work.
He's getting desperate.
And in stage two of killing the boys, it also seems to be expanded. Kol HaBen HaYilod. So Paro has a pattern here.
Mission creep.
There's a mission creep. There's a pattern here. Now, you could argue that this is part of Paro's plan, that he does it slowly, first privately, and the people get used to it. He's able to expand the decree. Or you could say, well, it didn't work the first time. The first time he tells them to work the Jews hard until they die, the Torah says explicitly it had the opposite effect. The more that he inflicted them, the more they grew. And the same thing we're told explicitly in the Torah about the midwives. They simply refused to listen to Paro's order. And then he has to open, that's why he has to open up both decrees to all of the all the people.
If he was so intent on killing the Jews, why didn't he just kill the daughters as well as the sons?
So that's a good question. It could be that even Paro had to take real politic into consideration, meaning there's only a certain amount that the population is going to accept. And the population is going to accept killing the boys, but what's the point? Don't kill the girls. They're not going to be soldiers anyway. They're not part of the problem. Don't kill the old men.
But
there's only a...
boys have always been the favorite of Jewish families. The boys was
right.
Always the favorite.
Well, that's not Pyro's concern. Pyro's concern is that they're going to grow up to be soldiers.
Okay.
Now, did it work?
Then it's a sexist point of view, too.
What do you mean?
Well, women can be used as wives, concubines, sex slaves.
Maybe. Could be. Did it work?
Are they not worth anything?
How do you know?
They hit the boy, Moshe.
That's what they thought.
So on the one hand, you could say, look at the sheet. Maybe not. Because what do we read in the very next chapter? Chapter 2, verse 1. Vayelech ish mi beit Levi, vayikach et bat Levi, vatara isha. Despite the fact that Paro had made this decree, people are still having children. It didn't work.
No, you say they couldn't have children.
Right, but people are rebelling. People are, right? Or
one baby lives.
It's true. Or you could say it didn't work. It did work. How do we know it worked? The fact of the matter is they had to get rid of him.
Oh, yes.
Right? They had to put him in a little, bucket and float him down the Nile River. So maybe it was working. Right? So we it's unclear. It's unclear whether Paro's decree, it's clear that the first decree didn't work. It's unclear what on the second decree.
No,
we don't know for sure.
They still had babies. That wasn't.
But it's unclear whether he was successful in killing them. We don't know. The Torah simply doesn't tell us.
Say some one person lived.
Right. Right, because the Torah is now switching to the story of Moshe.
Sure.
But the Torah doesn't tell us that this many people were killed. This many boys were killed.
I'm sure that
we simply don't know. We don't know.
What was the time schedule on all of this from the time he first started?
It's hard to tell. So what you so the we have a pattern here. We have first of all two separate attempts by Paro to limit the population. One through work, and one through killing the boys. And within each attempt, we have a pattern. Stage one, failure. Stage two, and an open-ended question as to whether or not the decree worked. Because even though there are hints in the text whether or not the decree worked, there's no specific mention in the text whether or not the decree worked. So the question is, what do we get from this pattern, right? What are we supposed to learn, right, from the fact that in both cases Paro had a stage one and it failed, and then he had a stage
he's
two.
He's getting more desperate with the people.
Divine intervention.
So he's going to start doing something else.
He is getting more desperate. That's true. He is getting more desperate. Rabbi Samet has an interesting suggestion as to why we have this sort of double attempt. Stage one, failure and attempt. He says that often in the Torah, when you want to show real victory, you have to show victory through sort of the original attempt to defeat you, and then the sort of, it's like a football game, right? If the team is being beaten, they go into the locker room at halftime, right? And they come up with a new strategy. And if they come out and they're still beaten, right, then it proves that the team that beat them was just better, really had their number, right? That's what happens here. We have the first half, and power was beaten. Then we have a halftime, right? The verses that say it wasn't working. And so what does Paro do? He retools his plan, and it's unclear whether it worked. It's not a slam dunk that it did not work, but certainly it's a slam dunk that the first one didn't work, because it doesn't seem that Paro would have said, let's kill the boys, if the hard work was doing the job. So the fact that Paro, after he gives them the second stage of hard work, then comes back and says, no, we have to kill all the boys, it seems that that first column, the work decree, was a complete failure. Whether or not the decree to kill the boys was successful or not, we also don't know. But it seems that maybe this is what the Torah is telling us, that that it's like it's sort of a precursor to Paro's defeat. He has no chance from the outset. We see this is not going to work. There's something in the background, which we're going to now realize later, is God, right? That is not allowing Paro to win. He could give them as much work as he wants. They're still going to have more children. He could declare that the kids have to be killed. It's not going to work. And so it could be that that's why we have the stage one and the stage two, to show that what we're showing here is absolutely an utter defeat of Paro, foreshadowed in the very beginning of the story, which we're only going to come to realize much later at the end of the story when the Jews are leaving. When the Jews are leaving Egypt. If you read it this way, then we know it's sort of a spoiler. If we read it this way, we know at the outset that Paro was going to lose. He was outcoached. If you want to go back to the football analogy. So I want to end with one more question. A question I mentioned earlier, which is, were these midwives Jewish or not?
So they feared God.
So, well,
I think
it's interesting to know. So there's a big debate. Some of the commentaries say they were Jewish. Some of the commentaries say they were not Jewish. I think if you look, I want to try to answer this question based on this analysis, based on the stage one and the stage two. If you compare the work decree and the decree to kill the male children, it seems clear who these midwives were. Any suggestions?
They said the midwives feared God.
So? Goyim fear God all the time.
Yeah, so
they started with the Jews, but then later on.
Based on the analysis that we did.
What? Maybe Egyptians.
Why would you say that based on what we did, what we studied?
Because the first ones were Egyptians.
First who?
Taskmaster.
Yes, I think that's exactly the point. Very good. If we're right, if Rabbi Salmon is right, that there is a parallel between what Paro did. In stage one, he takes his department of labor and says, enslave the Jews. Then in stage one of the decree to kill the children, who would he have asked? His officials.
Do we know the taskmaster?
One second. His officials. Right? And then and stage two, it's also parallel. All of Egypt puts the Jews to work, and all of Egypt are told to hunt down the Jews. Correct. According to one of the commentaries, according to some of the commentaries, he makes a greater point. These Shifra and Pua were not the two only midwives. They were the sarim, the sarot. They were the heads. That even makes it a better parallel, right? If you look in verse 11, who does Paro speak to? He speaks to Sarenisin, right? They are the Sare. They are the head of the taxers, Right? There's a lot of them. But he tells the head of the Department of Labor, go get me a bunch of Jews. And in turn, the Department of Labor gets all their officials to enslave the Jews. That's the same thing.
I can't imagine that Pharaoh would have Jewish midwives killing Jewish children. I mean, that doesn't seem plausible. Right.
That's a good question.
This is why here.
No, but Shonya's question is, why would Paro even think that would work?
Because you have to think who were the Me'aldot. I mean, who the Jews used as Me'aldot. And if the Jews did not use Me'aldot Mitzriot, Egyptian Me'aldot is midwives, I mean, there is no point to call.
Right. So, like I said, there's a big debate as to who they were, but our analysis would seem to indicate that they were Egyptian.
Taskmasters, even in later times, Jews were taskmaster over Jews.
Because it says Sarei Misim. It seems to be that these are people who are Paro's Sarim. Sar is an official in the government.
But excuse me.
It seems more likely, I think you can read it the other way, but I'm suggesting no. It seems more likely that Paro, when he first started, right, would have turned to his own people, right, to do this, as opposed to Jews enslaving the Jews.
Somebody also said Shifra and Pua are not, although I know you didn't say that, but they're not Hebrew names.
But since...
Right, they're Hebrew names.
Yes.
We took them on. French. But correct, they're B'Makor, right, in their origin, they're not Hebrew names. Mm-hmm. Right. Correct. Neither is Moshe a Hebrew name.
A lot of names were not Jewish.
Now, by the way, if in fact they're not Jews, those are another beautiful parallel, right? Who ultimately was responsible then for the redemption of the Jewish people? We have three outsiders. We have Moshe, who was Jewish, but was raised in the house of Paro as an Egyptian, and he becomes the Redeemer. And we have Shifra and Pua, also are outsiders, and they refuse to listen to Paro, even if they were Egyptians. So it's very interesting that the redeemers, or the saviors in this story, that we're introduced to in the story, are all outsiders. None of them are, I would call, pure. Moshe is Jewish, but certainly, right, as I just said, grows up in the house of Paro, and Shifra and Pua, very possibly, weren't Jewish at all. And they were Egyptian.
Well, you've got to say that Pharaoh isn't a fool. I mean, he seems to think this through and kind of organized
right.
But he believed himself to be, the speaker believed him to be a living God.
Yeah, when we look at these patterns, you see that Paro had this well thought out. Because it makes sense. At first, I'm going to try to handle this quietly. I'm going to first talk to my own people. Both in the decree to work and the decree to kill. When that doesn't work, he has to expand it and get everyone involved. And so that's an interesting, interesting parallel we find. And this helps us sort of give a framework to what happens at the beginning of Sefer Shemot.
That when he spoke to his two midwives, there had to be more than one of the Jews were multiplying they had to be more than two midwives.
Right.
No, there were hundreds probably.
Right.
Just this was
these were the bosses. Right, exactly. These were the bosses.
Everybody says it.
Okay, everybody. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
You want these back?